I'm Jed Bodwin, and you are listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Peter Holsapel. His new album, The Face of 68, is out everywhere on April 18th. It's a formidable entry into his discography, a collection of songs that finds him reflecting on aging, friendship, love, and loss, with equal measures of ferocity and humor. Holsapel discussed the making of the album and reflected on his influences and continued passion for creating and absorbing music, as well as his longtime friendships with fellow DB's members Chris Stamey, Will Rigby, and Gene Holder, as well as fellow musicians Mitch Easter and Don Dixon, who served as producer for The Face of 68. That's Peter Holsapel on Into Music, coming up now. What inspired this? Was this one of those things where it's like, it's just time to make another record? Or was it you were feeling really strong about songs you were writing? What happened?
That's interesting. That I've done about four interviews so far, and that is the first question that everybody asks about this record. What made you want to do it? Because, and then there's a little voice in the back of my head saying, they think I'm crazy. They think I'm nuts to do this. 69-year-old new artist. Surely you jest. Is that even possible? Do people do that? You know, and yes, they do. But what inspired me was I finished writing and doing a demo of Larger Than Life, which was the first song that was released by Label 51 to the general throng. And, you know, it's a song about my friend Carlo Nucia, who died, who was the drummer and nominally the leader of the Continental Drifters, and this truly one of the most overriding spirits of that band. And we lost him, and it's still grief is really hard to process. So what I do is I write a song about it, you know, and I actually wrote a couple about Carlo, but that was one that just all kind of fell together at once, and that felt really good. I trust songs that do that. And I sat back and I listened to the demo and I thought, that's good. That's a rock guitar song. That's you singing with a rock band, even though you're the rock band on the demo. It's been a few years since Game Day. The statute of limitations for that record may have run out, so it might be safe to make another one. And this time, you know, when I went into the planning for it, I talked with my wife a lot about it. And she was like, well, you got to do the record you wanted to do, which was doing all the parts yourself and doing everything yourself. And you see where that got you. Why don't you try doing a record with a producer and a band? I was like, you are so smart. You are so smart. So we went up to Wes Lachaud's studio, in fact, which is 6.5 minutes from my house. And, went in for 3.5 days in January of last year and cut a record. It was kind of amazing. You know, I mean, I think people have done that in the past. I know that the Beatles would go in and cut records in an afternoon. Now, I'm not that prolific, but we had not rehearsed these songs, but I sent Rob Ladd and Robert Sledge and Don Dixon, who's the producer, my demos of songs. And Dixon and I weeded out down to about 12, I think, and we cut 11 of them and used 10. And so we knew going into it what we wanted to do was to make a guitar-oriented record like they used to do, you know? I mean, I have to think back on the stuff I started playing when I was in my earliest bands. And I don't mean like when I was 8 years old and playing out of the Golden Beatles songbook, but when, you know, when you'd gotten a reasonable guitar and amp situation squared away and you had friends your age and were playing and you had records besides your Beatle records that you liked and you started liking the kind of heavier stuff and they were, you know, you didn't have to be apologetic about it. You were 14 years old. Of course you like heavy music, right? You know, why would you not like Deep Purple? Why would anybody not like Deep Purple? Frankly, I mean, Christopher Cross played lead guitar for him at a gig. How about that? You know, I mean, Who doesn't love Christopher Cross and Deep Purple in the same sentence? So I realized at 68, as I was finishing up the recording of this stuff, that this was really kind of reflective of some of those bands that I had with Mitch and Chris in the 70s, where we were working up Spooky Tooth and we were working up The Move and we were working up Mott the Hoople and Flamin' Groovies when the records were brand new. I mean, the page turned with Big Star, obviously, and it's sort of, for lack of a better word, jangle pop. Oh, sorry. Oh, ow, ow. But, that stuff started later. And so I was okay with playing heavy music again, I still listen to my Taste records. I still listen to the first Mountain record before it was a band, I love that stuff. I love guitar tone. I love lead guitar. I've gotten to be a lead guitar player in my dotage. Who knows? Maybe when Deep Purple comes to town and if Steve Morse is sick, I can throw my hand up and say, I got it. But I love making this record. It felt really good to make it. It felt like the right thing to do for me. And I'm very excited because the people that I have sent the streaming to just to kind of make sure that I'm on the right footing with this thing, to make sure that I'm not just like completely nuts to put something out. And they're all like, this is some of the best stuff you've ever done. And I'll take it. I as we started with the enthusiastic, relevant also, makes me feel relevant. And that's how you can't pay for that shit.
There were two words that kept on coming back to me as I was listening. One was ferocious, and the other one was dangerous. And I love when I can go see a band. Maybe it's a band I've seen 10, 20 times, but there's just something so, there's an energy in the playing where it's like, I don't know what's going to happen. Like, chaos could break out. You know what I mean?
I think that speaks to the fact that we did not rehearse this record, that Robert and Rob knew it going into the studio. They knew what the songs were, but they may not have really known what to play until we all played it together. And I sort of played a basic, something like Larger Than Life. I do that chunky rhythm guitar first, and I came back and did the slide later. But when you're playing, and it's this musical conversation, not to get totally like new agey about it, but it is like a conversation. It's like I hear Robert and Rob before we play, or after we do it one time, and they'll like tighten it up and they'll say, this I think needs to go here. I think this needs to have a stronger accent here. I think this needs to you maybe try laying out here, and I hear that going on and I'm like, hey, I'm the songwriter. This is great. This is marvelous. These people are taking this woebegone baby that has been left on their proverbial doorsteps, and are taking it in and nurturing it, and they are helping it build strength and come to into its own self, And so, I've admittedly been a slave to the demos for many years. It's a great expression because it is exactly what it is. I mean, I came from watching Mitch and Chris do these incredible, elaborate demos. I mean, those guys would go to like school auctions of band and orchestra instruments and come away, spend $100 and get a tuba and a couple of cellos. And this is all when we were like totally obsessed with The Move and the first ELO record and stuff. So them getting cellos was a total natural development, so they would do all these things, on a task cat a TAC 2340, a four track. So they're bouncing everything down. They're bouncing and bouncing and like generations and generations and learning at the same time. How do you do this without losing all the fidelity in the world? And I tried to learn that too. I lived in a music building in New York for many years between girlfriends and apartments and gigs and tours, but I would always crash on that nasty ass couch we had in there. And there was a and Chris's 2340 was in there, and I had reels of tape that I would record four tracks on. I got to be a relatively proficient left-handed, right-handed drummer playing on a left-handed kit, which is Will's kit is lefty, so I was sort of like Jim Bonfanti from the Raspberries, Dennis Wilson going straight down. And I, serviceable drummer, really good bass player, I admit it, played every other instrument that we had sitting in there that you could plug into a channel of the 2340. And I did these elaborate demos, and I bounced and bounced and bounced. And I really didn't care about the fidelity. It was kind of it was like a field recorder for me. So I got obsessed with that over the years. And then I finally ended up with Pro Tools, right? Go out on the road with Hootie in the year that Katrina happened. And I had a little Pro Tools rig that Chris helped me set up with an M box and a pair of speakers and my laptop, right? And I had Pro Tools on it, and I had a couple of cheap microphones, MXL microphones, right? Everything else was like plugins. Wow, I can have compression, but I don't have to bring a compressor with me. This I'm in, so I did like dozens of songs out on the road with the Hooties. I brought it all back home, and it all got washed away in Katrina, but I did have mixes of everything on a CDR, so that was good. Again, it was like, how much shit can you put on these tracks? Let them breathe. I've never been one of those guys that can sit there and say, I'm thinking Edward Norton as Pete Seeger. Hey guys, I've got this song. Let me play it for you and sing it for you at the same time on electric guitar. And, because I think I just have always felt like I know what's best for the song. But I think you lose perspective if you do that. And I have to admit that at the as I encroach on my back 40 in life, I've never meant to be antisocial about it, but I just always was afraid of what people would come up with, But they listen to my suggestions now. They're okay with it, and they come up with their own based on it, and I'm okay with that. And that's a nice lesson to learn.
I wanted to touch on Larger Than Life because that, of course, was the first song I heard from the record. I think I understand it on a lyrical level a little bit better, but there are still some mysteries to it to me. So I feel like it's one of those things where it's like the thing that, as you mentioned with grief, sometimes I think we grapple with that idea of like the physical person is gone, but the, again, without being too new agey, but the energy, the memories, everything else, and then what do we do to make sense of it?
I agree. And the person in question, Carlo, was like the ultimate New Orleans guy in my life. I lived in New Orleens for about 7 years, but I'd started going down there. The first time I think I went down was playing with the DBs at the 1984 World's Fair with Alan Toussaint on a rotating stage. So I had a chance, we had Jeff Beninato was our bass player for many years. We had Harold Kelt in the band for a while. We had a manager, Jim Ford, who was from New Orleans. We had a crew, Jimmy Descant and David Wyatt as our tour manager and lights. So we were deep in the town and loved it. And I, as a problem drinker, found it was a particularly ferocious place for me to be, if you will. And so Carlo, who I met in New Orleans, but basically knew from Los Angeles, Carlo became like this kind of spirit guide for me in a lot of ways. We really liked a lot of the same music, but he had really incredibly strong opinions about stuff. And when I finally got in a I did some recording with him. I did, if you know the first solo record I did, Out of My Way. It's a great little record. Still sounds great. I think that one sounds good, and I think the songs are good, but I think it's just kind of dated. But Carlo was the drummer all over that, and was just a it added that incredible feel of a top flight New Orleans drummer, which is indescribable. You know, I mean, if you try to imagine being in a band with Zig Modelist, right? From the Meters, somebody who is just constantly inventive and thinking and a step ahead of you and a beat behind you, you know, a half a beat behind you. I have moments with Carlo that I love to remember. When Vicky and Susan joined the Continental Drifters, and Carlo would do these rolls at the end of a bar, and he'd roll into like the second beat of the next bar, and they were just looking at each other. Susan and Vicky were looking at each other like, "Stop the madness!" You know, but Carlo had it all under control, and we just grew to love that, the eccentricity of it all. And he had some personal eccentricities that got in the way of his professional ones, and it turned into a big mess, and we all parted company, and it was a tough time for everybody. There's a song on that record called I Am a Tree, also, that doesn't have Carlo on it, but does have Susan and Vicky on it significantly. And it's about Carlo's problems with that sort of stuff. So Carlo left the band, but we all got to be friends again. And then we ended up doing all these Drifter reunion gigs with him, you know, because Carlo is inescapable. He is just this guy. He's the hero of his own story, and rightly so. Nobody would ever take that away from him. He is like, when he got his act straight, when he got sober and got rid of all the drugs and the alcohol, he started taking care of people that had those problems and sponsored them quietly, efficiently. You know, I think a lot of people looked at the guy and thought, my God, if he came back from it, I can. He got married to a wonderful woman named Carmen that he loved with every fiber of his being, and she loved him back. And it's a love that will never die. And then he got cancer, and then he died. And it was like all of a sudden, this magnificent structure of a human being, larger than life, you know, and all that entails. That means the good and the bad of the larger than life. You know, Carlo was cancer was larger than life eventually. You know, so it's a love song. It's a communication. His widow and I have often remarked about the lines about, from time to time, please give us a sign, you know, and we get them, you know, we get them every so often. I find myself having conversations with the guy. I miss him. I miss him more than anybody I know. Sorry, I'm getting a little misty here thinking about that, but he just was the most inspirational cat to play with. He made me be a better musician. He made me be a better arranger. He made me think harder about parts of songs that I might have just kind of tossed off. And I feel like I enjoyed a remarkable experience having Carlo Nucio in my life.
The part about Give Me a Sign, I think, is particularly moving. Because there are those people, like I have, not everybody, of course, who I've ever lost, but there have been those people where it's like, I do get like little visitations from them. There'll be something and it's like, oh, they're here, you know?
Yeah. You know, when I think about stuff like that, I'm not a big believer in the afterlife and living your life because you get better watch out for that afterlife, you know, that sort of stuff. Not into that particularly. I'm just trying to make the best out of what I got here. But I find myself really wishing mostly that I could communicate with people. I wish I could communicate with Carlo. I feel like I do to a degree. You know, something will move on the shelf, right? That's cool. But the people that I most wish I could talk to are my father, because I found him an incredibly fascinating and inscrutable man that accomplished a lot of things, but sort of went about it in an incredibly anonymous way. And I would love to ask him about parenting, you know, because I've done that. My kids are now 31, 21, and 17. So I'm on the, the arc is going toward the empty nest. So I'm just curious to see, You know, when I learned that I was never going to parent like my father, a huge weight was lifted off me and I got to be a much better parent. And then the other person would be my big brother, who I lost in 97, I think. And I miss him. You know, he's a guy I wish I'd known better, but he was 11 years older than me. So we were like two only children. What do you do? That's why I always encourage my 31-year-old and 21-year-old to stay in touch, especially when I pop off, you know. Please, these are your siblings. They really are your siblings, you know. So blood tells.
My eldest brother is 16 years older than me. So, yeah, we didn't. I wish we would have had more of that, like our parents saying, you know, remember your siblings. He's not your uncle. He's not your father. He's your brother, you know, to keep that unity. So,
well, you know, yeah, I mean, it was weird because my brother predeceased my parents, which is not the natural order of things. And so I had to deal with grieving parents also. And then my dad died, and then my mom was just sort of hung on because she was just too ornery to die. You know, she just wouldn't go. She knew she wanted to go, but she had worked to have this, be surrounded in this condominium by the things that she wanted and loved. And apart from my father, who waited on her every day of his life, she had it. She didn't want to leave it. So how is your elder brother still with us? Is he deceased?
Yeah, he's let's see. He's going to be 69 this year.
Okay.
Yeah. So
still compass mentis?
Yep.
Give him a call, man.
Yeah.
Give him a call or write him or something. And we'll get back to the record in just a second, but I've been kind of, yesterday was a tough day with Sal Mehta and Sean Brighton both passing away. Two people whose music I respect tremendously and two people I knew only kind of in passing, but enough to acknowledge and tip my hat to, you know. I think that's important. I'm trying to live my life like that now, to reach out to the people that the music is important to you. You know, I mean, this is going to sound totally ridiculous. So growing up in Winston-Salem, we had the Winston-Salem Journal. That was the daily newspaper, right? And the Sunday, the Journal Sentinel. The afternoon paper was the Sentinel. The Sunday paper was the Journal Sentinel. There was one arts writer for music. His name was Jim Scherzer. And he was the one guy that they fobbed off all the pop writing to. And he was just sort of like, you know, before rock writers became rock writers, you know, the before Lester Bangs and Robert Hilburn and Chris Gow and, you know, Ben Edmonds and John Ned Mendelsohn and people like that, before they took on this sort of persona, this sort of auteur theory of pop journalism. They were all kind of, I can almost liken it to like Frankie Avalon before the Beatles, you know, like, here's pop music. No, no, no. Here's pop music. So the pop music criticism was like that too. So Mr. Scherzer was like the Frankie Avalon of pop writers in Winston-Salem. And he kept this job for a long ass time, long past his, what felt like his relevance to what he was writing about. You know, it's like, why don't send this guy to see Mandrake Memorial and Towns Van Zandt? This is not going to mean anything to him. You know, so finally, my friend Ed Baumgartner, who was a really excellent bass player, rock savant, and very, you know, evocative auteur writer, took over, and it was a different ballgame entirely. And we had a really good pop scene. They had all of that stuff, but I think about that, and so the other day I looked it up, and by God, Jim Scherzer is still with us, and I got an address, and I'm thinking, you know, should write him a letter and just at least say, thanks for being there every week with something, at least. I may not have agreed with you, and I may have, you know, I won't get into the details, but I'll just say thanks, because I feel like sometimes you got to do that. I wrote to a disc jockey who was like hugely important to all of us in Winston-Salem, a guy named the Flying Dutchman, and his real name is Pete Berry. And he lives in like Hialeah, Florida, or something like that. Retired, probably lives in a trailer down the road from Pet Perrine from the Bob Seger system. But Pete Berry was great. He was this personality jock on WTOB, and he would do stuff like hang in an Airstream trailer suspended by a crane 30 feet in the air for 2 days broadcasting for WTOB. That kind of jock, you know? And I wrote to him because I was like, my God, he's still alive. I don't think it hurts to send somebody a note and say, this is what you meant to me. Thank you. I appreciate it. Because when I have people come up to me, I have to say, that's another thing about that DVS tour that was really poignant. It affected me very much. I would go out after shows. I was one of the band members that would go out after shows and go mingle after most shows and talk to people. Because I really think that that is an important part of what you do as a professional entertainer or musician. You need to acknowledge these people who have come to see you do what you do because they really like what you do. And that's their way of showing you that they like what you do and telling you what you're doing has an effect on them. So I get to go out there and I get to meet people and I get to thank them and I get to sign their records because they want them signed. What a great gig. What a great thing to be able to do, especially 42 years after the fact for those two records. That's really neat. I hope, and I think I'm being realistic and not just optimistic, but I hope that people who come out for shows that I do in support of the Face of 68 will have that enthusiasm. I don't know that I'm going to be able to be a band for all of the shows because I will say that touring with a band in 2025, I think I would have to mortgage my firstborn, and I don't know that she would be really enthusiastic about that. We'll see. But and I have friends with trailers now that I could probably rent a trailer from. But you want everybody comfortable and happy, and you don't want to just always go out and play a Tuesday night, between beer pong competitions and Jägermeister luge hotties. I don't want to feel like an obstacle. I want to feel like an attraction. I don't want to feel like I'm a bump in the road. I want people. That's why I love house concerts. I'm a total devotee of house concerts because when you play a house concert, people come to see you play. They've come to see you. You're not this thing that's over by the ping pong tables. You're not over by the where the sports TVs are blasting. You're the focus. Is that too much to ask? I don't know. Sometimes. Well, I mean, but the house concert, that's the point of the house concert. People are actually paying like reasonable amounts of money to sit in a room with 25 of their fellow fans of yours that know your music, and they're going to sit and you're going to entertain them at close range without a lot of gee-jaws and amplification to make it into this production thing. Again, you have to simplify it. You have to make these songs work in a different context because, as you say, this record is a different kind of record for me. This is a harder record. It's a guitar with edge record, of which I am exceedingly proud. Now, can it be done on an acoustic guitar? Yes, it can. I have tried it out and it works beautifully. And so the ferocity is going to have to come from the performance, not from the volume. And that's great. I can do that. So that's what people need to watch for. So I'm glad you liked Larger Than Life. That's a good song, isn't it? It sort of all came together at once, and I really trusted how, when a song falls together with the lyrics and the music pretty much part and parcel, that's the hallmarks of a really trustworthy piece of music, I think.
Kind of want to go back to something we were talking about at the beginning about, why was this a time for the record? And you're talking about, feeling creative and, and kind of saying, you know, hey, at this moment in my life, I've still got these songs. They're still coming. And as we were talking, I was also thinking about how Slim Dunlap recently passed away.
Yeah.
And how there were people who said, oh, he's got all these great songs that were never recorded, you know, by him. And so we don't have those with his voice and his performance. And so I'm very much of the mind of, like, you know, don't hesitate, go forward, make the art, because somebody's going to embrace it.
I think the technology has been winnowed down to a very easy, operator-friendly platform to which allows you, even with just one of these, you can take this and you can sit there and you can sing into it. And on a neat little app called Music Memos, you can have a bass line and a set of drums going to it, even if you don't have a guitar. So why not, right? I mean, get ideas down. There's a song on the record called My Idea Number 49. And the essence of the title of that is a music memo demo that I had done. And it always saves as my idea. And this was my idea number 49. And I thought, sure, you know, the one after 909, Funk 49. Oh, sorry, Funk 48. Oh, wait, what? You know, and it just was like, the technology was there. And so I did it on that. And then I always pump that into my Pro Tools and have a track of whatever the demo is. But I think if people have it in them, they should do it. You know, if they want to play music, I just played a sold out show with my high school band, Little Diesel, in Winston-Salem on Saturday night. And it was so great. All these 69-year-old men up there playing the Standells and the MC5 and Alice Cooper and Slade and all that stuff we grew up on. And we played it enthusiastically, and we played it with a whole new elan, I think. You know, we had played around the time of our 50th anniversary high school reunion last year. And I was the only one that, actually, I went to mine, and our lead other guitar player went to the other one for his school, which was down the hall. So we just met up in the middle of the hall and hung out. But we enjoyed it so much, it was like, let's do it again. So we went back and we sold out again. So the cool thing is, our bass player is the head of a brokerage firm in Winston-Salem. He is a very successful brokerage and financial advisor. He is my broker and financial advisor and was my parents. And I think that our parents would be delighted that we are still friends and playing together. But when I talk to him before and after the show, I see a guy who has a renewed interest in playing at 69 years old. He has a renewed vigor for picking up an instrument that's really kind of a hard instrument to pick up by itself, right? It's not like strumming on an acoustic guitar. Hey, I'll play Blowing in the Wind, you know, hey, whatever. But a bass is a more ensemble piece, and if it can be, you know. But he's interested and he's excited and he wants advice. And I loaned him a tuner, a floor tuner, and we tried to get it hooked up for him before the show. And it was more than he had the learning curve to operate at that point. It was fine, but I want him to get used to these things. I want to give him the key to the technology. I said, you know, he said, I got to get an amp. Can you bring an amp for me? And I was like, well, no, I'm using my amp as a keyboard amp, so can't use that. Why don't you use our lead singer's amp? He's like, okay, he'll bring that. And he was like, I got to get an amp. He's like, we were like, well, you should probably get these Fender Rumble amps. There's a 200 and a 300. And he was like, drew back and whinged and said, 300, well, I would never need 300 watts. And I'm like, dude, calm down. You may need it. It's better to have and not need than need and not have, in the words of Don Covey. So that's where you want to go with this. So it's lovely to watch this enthusiasm, this burning enthusiasm of a guy who really hadn't picked up a bass in 40 some odd years, really, you know. And he's having the time of his life, and we're all having the time of our lives. And it's so adorable. They'll come up to me afterward and say, did I play okay? Like, I'm grading them. You know, I mean, Me and Will are the, you know, he and I, Will's the drummer, Will Rigby from the DBs. And he and I played together, obviously, since Little Diesel. And we are connected and we play really well together. So that's a good foundation. Our lead singer, Bob Northcott, is still a great, amazing singer. Our lead guitar player has gone off the deep end and he's nuttier than ever. We love that. And there's Phil, our bassist, who is just trying to hold down the bottom. I watched him. He came to see the DBs at Sika in Winston-Salem, and it was adorable. He just sat there, fixated on Gene Holder. He came down from his seat and sat there. And I might as well not have been on the stage. He was just like laser focused. And he said afterward, "I wanted to watch Gene and listen to him and see what he does in your band and see how I can be more like that." And I said, "Aren't you fortunate you share the same drummer? You can pick up a lot of stuff from what Gene's doing and apply it to what you're doing with Will yourself." And he's like, "Yes, I can." So it's great. You know, this is a, it's like watching this magic go back. You know, it's like the conversation from 50 years ago really just kind of picked up where it left off. How neat is that? I'm a lucky guy. I got new shit, I got old shit. What do you want?
You've been listening to a conversation with Peter Holsapple. His latest album, The Face of 68, is out everywhere April 18th. You can learn more about him at his blog, Does This Band Make Me Look Fat?, as well as his official social media accounts and through the Label 51 Recordings website, label51recordings.com. Our digital producers are Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Hugo Fan. Our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We will see you next time.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.